He spent that day as he spent every other, as an amateur archaeologist, sifting the wreckage in search of answers. He didn't know what exactly had happened here after he'd left, why such massive physical destruction had proven necessary in the wake of their escape. Those left behind had been in no position to mount much of a defense, as far as he could tell. Maybe someone had just wanted to make an example of them. Back when he'd still been sleeping in his tent, Brooks had gone to it for answers, voiced queries and search strings to the fabric, and trawled through the closest hits that the clouds had to offer. But relevant insights seemed impossible to find. Perhaps humans had covered up the details. Perhaps networks, fearful of impending schizophrenia, had simply forgotten them. It had been a long time since Brooks had used consensus. It didn't really matter. Those weren't the answers he was looking for. He realized now that Luckett had been right. There had been a plan, and all had happened in accordance with it. It was the only model that fit the data. The idea that mere baselines had been able to vanquish the bicamerals made about as much sense as positing that a band of lemurs could outthink Jim Moore at battlefield chess. The Hive had only lost because they'd been playing to lose. Dan Brooks had only escaped because they'd wanted him to. He was only back here now, looking for answers, because they had left answers for him to find. Eventually, he would find them. It was only a matter of time. He knew this. He had faith. A great pit gaped off the northeast corner of the ruin. Walls had shattered and spilled toward it during the purge. But that loose scree had only made it halfway. Some other force had flattened the waist-high guardrail that had once ringed the pit at a safe distance. Brooks stepped over it with ease and across the concrete apron. He could not see the bottom, not clearly. Sometimes when the sun was high, he caught the dim glint of great radial teeth deep in the earth, cutting across the shaft. He would kick pebbles over the edge. Water splashed after a long time, and occasionally he would see the fitful blue spark of short-circuiting electricity. Still life down there, then, of a sort. He idly considered exploring farther. There had to be some kind of access to those depths, an air intake at least, but there was plenty of time for that. There were other, more ambulatory hazards to contend with. Rattlesnakes seemed to be making a comeback, or at least changing their distribution. An unthinking reach into dark places while clearing debris resulted in a couple of close calls and a welcome supplement to his freeze-dried rations. Some exotic species of locust had discovered fire while he'd been away, set a patch of dead grass alight one morning while Brooks was digging nearby. He watched it crackle and blacken, and only later discovered the charred little carcasses along the edge of the burn, not quite strong enough to leap clear of their own conflagration. The coder couldn't ID them below family, but named Cortoisetes as the closest known relative. Australian plague locust, too far from home and freshly equipped with a novel variant of chitin, whose frictional coefficient proved positively incendiary during mating calls. Plagues and firestorms in a single package. How very apocalyptic. Some splicer somewhere had a refreshingly biblical approach to weaponized biologicals. He had a visitor that afternoon. Watched for almost an hour as it grew from speck to heat shimmer to biped staggering across the eastern flats. Stuck with roach vision, he almost didn't identify it in time. Almost started out to meet it before that peculiar stagger tipped him off and sent him scuttling for cover. The newcomer wasn't running, but he moved fast and unencumbered. No pack, no canteen. Only one sneaker on the end of a leg as dark and leathery as beef jerky. Whoever he was more than dehydrated. He was almost skeletal. His left arm hung as if snapped at the humerus. He didn't seem to care. He kept up that jerking, half-panicked stride, stumbled past the monastery without a glance, zigzagged onto the western horizon under a lethal simmering sun. Brooks hid in the ruins and watched him pass, and did not get a good look at his eyes. He didn't think they danced, though. He was not that kind of undead. He hunkered down in the calm between the stones and tried to remember which way the wind was blowing. Valerie appeared after sundown. She materialized from the darkness, half visible in the bloody flickering light of his campfire, and dropped a bag of supplies at his feet. Tinned food now, mostly. No more of the magic foil pouches that instantly heated your stew or froze your ice cream when you ripped them open. The pickings out there must be getting slim. He grunted a greeting. Haven't seen you since... He couldn't exactly remember. She'd brought him here. He remembered that much. Hadn't she? He had flashes sometimes. A rain-soaked shoreline. A man who'd thought a contraption of metal and plastic was worth dying for. A disembodied eye trailing ragged shreds of nerve and tendon. Almost too cloudy to unlock the retina-coated driver's door. A pair of polarized sunglasses in her hand. Terrible backlit eyes staring right through him while she clicked bared teeth and asked, "Do I?" He remembered saying, "Yes." He'd said, "Please," and hadn't even tried to keep the whine from his voice. She had been merciful. She had masked herself a little, a lion's concession to the lamb. Tonight, there was a light beyond his own, a dim orange glow on the northwestern horizon, some distant fire reflecting off the underbelly of a low-hanging cloud bank. Brooks put it in the general direction of Bend. He pointed back over her shoulder. "Did you do that?" She didn't look. "You do." He nodded at the lizard mash sizzling on the fire, held out the half-eaten Vita bar he'd been nibbling to take the edge off. Valerie shook her head. "I eat already." Even now, it was a relief to hear that. He sat back down on the corner of a shattered and empty mausoleum. "Found my room today." More precisely, he'd uncovered his goggles. One lens gone completely, the other a spiderweb of cracks embedded in the frame, and finally recognized the remains of the cell where he'd spent his last night on Earth before escaping to the sun. He'd spent the rest of the day searching those foundations on his hands and knees. Thought someone might have left something there, but her pupils glowed like embers in the firelight. "Doesn't matter," she told him. But somehow there was something under the words, an unspoken addendum. Brooks wasn't entirely sure how he knew that. Some subtle telltale in the way Valerie held herself, perhaps. Some twitch of the lip that his subconscious had parsed and served up as an executive summary. Wrong scale. Look down. And suddenly Brooks saw the truth of it. They'd known him, these hive-minded transhumans who'd called him back home. They'd known his background and what he'd been doing in the desert all those months before. Any answers they'd left for him would be for him alone, too subtle to show up under the ham-fisted forensics of mortal man, too durable for bombs or bulldozers to destroy. They'd be ubiquitous, indestructible, invisible to all but their intended recipient. He mentally kicked himself for not having seen that before. He wasn't exactly sure how he'd seen it now, exactly what cues he'd read in Valerie's body language, or even whether those cues had been deliberate or inadvertent. It had been happening more often, though, as though the desert had cleared his head, washed away the electronics and the interference and the ubiquitous quantum chaos of the 21st century. To leave his mind as sharp and pristine as an undergrad's. His newfound clarity might have even saved his life on occasion. He'd got the strong sense that a wrong answer to some of Valerie's campfire questions might have carried severe penalties. "Is this what augmentation feels like?" he wondered. But it couldn't be. He hadn't even taken Cognitol for weeks. He was seeing things more clearly now, though. No doubt about it. Faces in the clouds, patterns that made his brain itch. Rakshi would have been proud. Even Valerie seemed to be. Her visits, once rare, had become more frequent. The first time she'd been a shadow with a face, there and gone so quickly that Brooks had written her off as a post-traumatic flashback. But she'd returned 6 nights later, and 2 nights after that. And then she had stayed, lurking just beyond the campfire, twin spots of eyeshine hovering in the darkness. At first he'd thought she was toying with him again, getting her usual sadistic kicks out of scaring prey. But then he remembered that she wasn't like that after all, and she obviously didn't want him dead. The fact that he was alive was all the proof he needed. One night, he'd shouted a challenge into the darkness. "Hey, don't you ever get bored playing the monster card?" And she'd stepped into the light, hands spread, lips sealed, watching him, watching her. She'd left a few minutes later, but by then he'd realized what she was doing. She was an anthropologist, incrementally acclimating some primitive tribesman to her presence. She was a primatologist of days past, easing her way into a doomed colony of bonobos, one last behavioral study before the species checked out for good. Sometimes now she sat across the fire and asked him riddles, like some demonic inquisitor assessing his fitness to survive another night. Questions about traveling salesmen or Hamiltonian circuits. He'd been terrified at first, afraid to answer, afraid not to, convinced somehow that whatever Valerie's interest in keeping him alive, it could end in an instant with the wrong response. He had done his best and knew that it wasn't good enough. What did he know about bin packing or polynomial time? How could any mortal keep up with a vampire? But she hadn't killed him yet. She had not turned him back to stone with a few words. She no longer drummed out strange tattoos with her fingertips or left mind-altering hieroglyphics scratched into the sand. They were beyond that now. Besides, he didn't quite know how, but he was starting to guess some of the right answers. He began again with the most obvious signpost, the magic wash basin, the defiant patch of grass that circled it like a green pupil. He sampled the water, scraped flecks from the stone, pulled leaves from the ground and ran them through his barcoder. He found 1,000 common bacteria, a few purebred, most rotten with lateral transfer. He only found one that glowed in the dark. It wasn't obvious, of course. It wouldn't have lit up the night to any naked eye, not in the minuscule densities the machines reported. The only way he could tell it fluoresced was from the gene sequence itself. 576 nucleotides that shouldn't have been there, an assembly line for a protein that glowed red in the presence of oxygen. A marker of some kind, a beacon. He couldn't read it at first. He had seen the light, but the genes to either side seemed unremarkable. It was a road sign in the desert, with no roads in sight. He let his hands and feet guide him. The answer would come. He explored corridors and wood-paneled chambers at the south end of the complex. More than merely intact, pristine, stripped bare. Light rectangles punctuating the faded dumb paint where pictures had once hung. He found a pair of Masaso's mahogany knuckles hiding in the corner behind a smashed door. He found what was left of his bike. A pair of mangled handlebars, an axle fork, a distended bladder of tire bulging from beneath a fallen wall like a hyperinflated football. But it wasn't until the dead of night that he found the body. He hadn't found any others. Most likely the authorities had disposed of them. Or perhaps, against all the evidence of his own eyes, they had escaped somehow. Stranger things had happened. But he woke in the night to the echo of rock falling nearby, and his memory was somehow able to pick a path through the ruins when mere starlight failed. His feet found their way through the wreckage without a missed step. His ears tracked the soft rattle of gravel flowing down new slopes in the darkness ahead. Eventually, he came to a jagged shadow where none had been before, a fresh cave-in gaping through the shattered tiles. Brooks stood shivering at its edge and waited for the sky to lighten. The corpse resolved in shades of gray at the bottom of the pit, a dim, shapeless blob against darkness. A shadow extruded from jumbled debris, a bundle of dark sticks wrapped in a tunic on the basement floor. It lay on its back, buried to its waist by the cave-in. The body had mummified in the desert air, shriveled down to bones and brown leather. The eyes through which it stared at the sky had long since collapsed into empty sockets. Perhaps, once, the arms had been folded peacefully across the chest. Now they were hooked and twisted as if bent by some disfiguring disease, wrists torqued inward, fingers clawing at the sternum. "It's pointing at itself," he realized. "At itself." And with the sparkling clarity of his newfound faith, Daniel Brooks finally saw the body for what it was. It was a sign. "It was a marker," he told Valerie the next time she appeared. Two nights later? Three? It was pointing at itself. So obvious, in the hindsight of revelation. The same sequence that coded for fluorescence contained other information as well. The same tangled thread of amino acids both serving a mundane biological function and spelling out a more esoteric message to anyone who knew the right alphabet. Not just a marker, not just a message. It was a dialogue, gene and protein, talking to each other. It was a straight transposition of amino into alphabet, valine, threonine, alanine, into THE. Phenylalanine, glutamine, valine, alanine, into FATE. Serine, press-ganged into hard space or hard return, depending on the iteration. The fluorescent protein spelled out a message. "The fairy is rosy, of glow. In fate we rely." And the complementary codons directing its construction spelled out another, in a different alphabet. "Any style of life is prim. O stay, my lyre." A free verse call and response packed down into a measly 140 codons. It was a marvel of cryptographic efficiency, and it was obvious once Brooks had seen the light. The sequence spells a message and codes for a protein. The protein fluoresces and contains a response. It's not contamination or lateral transfer. It's a poem.
"Not for you," Valerie said. "You're looking for something else."
"No," he thought. "You are." "This is not a kink," he said after a while, and ignited the campfire.
"You mean I don't get off on keeping retarded pets?"
Her eyes flared red-orange.
"I'm not Rakshi Sengupta."
"And I'm pretty sure you're not here for the sheer enjoyment of my company." She did not cry out in disagreement. "So what is this?" Valerie's face was unreadable.
"What do you think?"
"I figure I'm cheap labor. The odds of finding something useful here are too high to ignore, and too low to waste much effort on. You've got a lot of irons in the fire, so now and then you wait until the sun goes down and drop by to see what I've dug up." She eyed him for a moment. Brooks looked back at that vaguely lupine face, alive with dancing shadows, and wondered when he had stopped finding it so terrifying.
"Daniel," she said at last, "how you underestimate yourself."
The truth was, though, Valerie did seem to enjoy his company. The tone of their conversations had changed, no longer an inquisition. Their forays into philosophy and viral theology were turning into something almost conversational. She no longer thought rings around him. Occasionally, now, he even seemed able to challenge her. He still wasn't sure where this newfound facility was coming from. His subconscious simply served up the right responses without bothering to show its work. It frightened him, at first, the way new thoughts spilled from his mouth before he could check them for veracity. Before he could even parse their meaning. He bit down to no avail, grew queasy, almost terrified by his own insights, while Valerie cocked her head and watched from some prehistoric remove. It was those same insights that eventually calmed him. After all, wasn't this the way the human brain had always behaved? The bolt from the blue? The classic fully formed eureka moment? Hadn't the structure of benzene come to Kekulé in a dream? He began to have his own dreams. He heard voices in them, insistent whispers. "She's behind it all. She set it all up, can't you see that? Broke out of jail, snuck through the nets and the ether, got past the best firewalls baselines could build, flashed false ID to false intelligences, snuck a carousel out of the garage with a whole squad of zombies on board and didn't wake anyone up on her way out. She bluffed her way onto the Crown of Thorns, conveniently made it back from Icarus when everyone else burned. You think it was a bunch of monks that locked you up with the woman who'd sworn to kill you? A diversion on demand, tripwired to go off like a flash grenade? It was the vampire. It was the vampire, and everyone else is dead. And the only reason you're not is because she wants to know God's plan for Daniel Brooks. She'll get what she wants, and then she'll kill you, too." On waking, he only remembered the voices. He couldn't quite remember what they'd said. Valerie kissed him two nights later. He didn't even know she was there until her hand snapped closed around the back of his neck, spun him around faster than even his brainstem could react. By the time his heart had jumped through the roof of his mouth, and his body remembered fight flight, and his cache had a chance to think, "This is it, she's done with me, I'm dead, I'm dead, I'm dead," her tongue was already halfway down his throat, and her other hand, the one not crushing his cervical vertebrae, had pincered his cheeks, forcing his teeth apart. He could not close his jaws. He hung, paralyzed in her grip, while she tasted him from the inside. He felt something through her flesh that might almost have been a heartbeat if it weren't so slow. Finally, she released him. He collapsed on the ground, scuttled sideways like a frantic crab caught in the open with nowhere to run. "What the fuck?" he gasped. "Ketones." She looked down through him, silhouetted by purpling twilight. "Lactate." "You can taste cancer," he realized after a moment. "Better than your machines." She leaned in close, grinning. "Maybe not so precise." Even eye to eye, she didn't seem to be looking at him. He knew it an instant before she moved. "She's going to bite me." But the sharp stabbing pain bolted up his arm, and her face hadn't moved a centimeter. He looked down, startled, at the twin puncture marks, only a centimeter apart, on his forearm, to the dual-punch biopsy gun in Valerie's hand, his own, he saw, from the field kit lying on the ground, flap open, vials and needles and surgical tools glinting in the firelight. "Sun gives you problems," Valerie said softly. "Too much radiation, not enough shielding." "At Icarus," he remembered, "when we thought we were burning you off the hull like a moth." "But you're easy to fix." "Why?" Brooks asked, and didn't even have to say that much to know that she understood. "Why help prey? Why help someone who tried to kill you? Why aren't I dead already? Why aren't we all?" "You bring us back," Valerie said simply. "To be slaves." She shrugged. "We eat you otherwise." "We bring you back, then enslave you in self-defense." But maybe she really did regard it as a good deal. Given a choice between captivity and outright non-existence, who would choose the latter? "I'm sorry," he didn't say. "Don't be," she replied, as if he had. "You don't enslave us. Physics does. The chains you build." Her fangs gleamed like little daggers in the firelight. "We break them soon."
"I thought you already had."
Rising moonlight lit her eyes for a moment as she shook her head.
"The glitch still works. I see the cross, and a part of me dies.
A part you made?
Of course, of course. They're parallel processors, after all.
The truth dawned on him like daylight. A custom cache. A sacrificial homunculus brought into existence and isolated. To suffer the agony of the cross, while more vital threads of cognition wound about it like a stream around a stone. Valerie didn't avoid the seizures at all. She insisted them, and carried on. He wondered how long she'd been able to do that.
Just a workaround, she said. Need to undo the wiring.
Not to go up against the roaches, of course. That war was already as good as over, even though the losing side didn't know it yet. This creature with a dozen simultaneous entities in her head, this prehistoric post-human, could speak so openly, without animosity or resentment, or the slightest concern for the impact one Daniel Brooks might have on her revolution. Because baseline humanity was already beneath her notice. Valerie and her kind were perfectly capable of shrugging off human oppression without breaking their chains. They needed their arms free to pick on things their own size.
You are not so small as you think, she said, reading him. You might be bigger than all of us.
Brooks shook his head. We're not. If I've learned anything, these...
Emergent complexity, he realized. That's what she means.
A neuron didn't know whether it fired in response to a scent or a symphony. Brain cells weren't intelligent. Only brains were. And brain cells weren't even the lower limit. The origins of thought were buried so deep, they predated multicellular life itself. Neurotransmitters and coenoflagellates. Potassium ion gates and monocyga.
I am a colony of microbes talking to itself, Brooks reflected.
Who knew what metaprocesses might emerge when heaven and consensus wired enough brains together, dropped internode latency close enough to zero? Who knew what metaprocesses already had? Something that might make bicameral hives look as rudimentary as the nervous system of a sea anemone.
Maybe the singularity already happened, and its components just don't know it yet. They never will, Valerie told him. Neurons only speak when spoken to. They don't know why.
He shook his head. Even if something is coalescing out there, it's left me behind. I'm not wired in. I'm not even augged.
Consensus is one interface. There are others.
Echopraxia, he wondered. But it didn't matter. He was still Daniel Brooks, the human coelacanth, lurking at the outskirts of evolution, unchanged and unchangeable while the world moved on. Enlightenment was enough for him. He wanted no part of transfiguration.
I will stay here while the tables turn and fires burn out. I will stand still while humanity turns into something unrecognizable or dies trying. I will see what rises in its place. Either way, I am witnessing the end of my species.
Valerie watched him from the darkness.
These chains you build, we break them soon.
I wish we hadn't needed them, he admitted softly. I wish we could have brought you back without crucifix glitches or divide and conquer, or any of those damn chains. Maybe we could have dialed down your predatory instincts, fixed the proto-cadherin deficit, made you more...
like you, she finished.
He opened his mouth, found he had nothing to say. It didn't matter whether shackles were built of genes or iron, whether you installed them after birth or before conception. Chains were chains, no matter where you put them, no matter whether they were forged by intent or evolution.
Maybe we should have just left you extinct, built something friendlier from scratch. You need your monsters, she said simply.
He shook his head. You're just too complicated. Everything's linked to everything else. Fix the crucifix glitch, you lose your pattern matching skills. Make you less antisocial,
Who knows what else goes away? We didn't dare change you too much.
Valerie hissed softly, clicked her teeth.
You need monsters so you can defeat them. No great victory in slaughtering a lamb.
We are not that stupid.
Valerie turned and looked to the horizon. The firelight flickering off the clouds was all the rejoinder she needed.
But that's not us, Brooks thought. Even if it is, it's urban renewal, tear down and development for the new owners. Pest control.
The monster's shoulders rose and fell. She spoke without turning.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could all just get along?
And for the life of him, Brooks could not tell whether she was being sincere or sarcastic.
I thought we were, he said, reaching for the biopsy needle in his half-open field kit,
and leapt like a flea onto her back, faster than he had ever moved in his life, to plunge it up through the base of her skull.
The clothes have no emperor. Stuart Guthrie.
Now he was alone. By day, tornadoes marched across the desert like pillars of smoke, under no control but God's. At night, the distant glow of burning bushes encircled the horizon. The post-Anthropocene explosion in full swing. Brooks thought about what might be going on out there, thought about anything but the act he'd just committed. He imagined battles unseen and ongoing. He wondered who was winning. The bicamerals, perhaps, shaping the singularity, planting that first layer of bearings in the box, laying a foundation for the future. Perhaps this was their linchpin moment, the first dusting of atoms on the condenser's floor. From these beginnings, humanity could resonate out across time and space, a deterministic cascade designed to undo what the viral god had wrought. Debug the local ordinances. Undo the anthropic principle. It could take billions of years from such humble butterfly beginnings. But in the end, life itself might be unraveled from plank on up. What else could you call it, other than nirvana? There would be forces, other plans. The vampires, for one. The smartest of the selfish genes. They might prefer their human prey just as they were, slow and thick-witted, minds dulled by the cumbersome bottleneck of the conscious cache. Or maybe some other faction was rising in the east, any of the other monstrous subspecies that humanity had fractured into. The membranes, the multicores, the zombies or the Chinese rooms, even Rona's superconscious AIs, they all had their causes. Their reasons to fight, or thought they did. The fact that their actions all seemed to serve the purposes of something else, some vast distributed network slouching toward Bethlehem. Sheer coincidence, perhaps. Perhaps we really do act for the reasons we believe. Perhaps everything's right on the surface, brightly lit and primary colored. Perhaps Daniel Brooks and Rashi Sengupta and Jim Moore, each burning for their own kind of redemption, all just happened to end up in the white-hot radiance of Spolar Orbit, obsessed enough to rush in where angels feared to tread. Perhaps it really was Daniel Brooks, on some level, who had just murdered his last and only friend. He thought of Jim Moore, and Jim was in his head, nodding and offering sage advice. Rona reminded him to think like a biologist, and he saw his mistake. He'd heard angels of the asteroids, and he'd seen heavenly bodies, not earthly ones. He'd seen chunks of dead spinning rock, not the extinct echinoderms that had once crept across the world's intertidal zones. Asteroidea, the sea stars. Brainless creatures, utterly encephalized, who nonetheless moved with purpose and a kind of intelligence. Not the worst metaphor for the Icarus invader. Not the worst metaphor for what seemed to be happening out beyond the desert. There were other voices. Valerie, Rakshi, some he didn't recognize. Sometimes they argued among themselves, included him only as an afterthought. They told him he was becoming schizophrenic, that they were nothing but his own thoughts, drifting at loose ends through a mind being taken apart in stages. They whispered fearfully about something skulking in the basement, something brought back from the sun that stomped on the floor and made things move upstairs. Brooks remembered Jim Moore cutting the cancers from his body, felt his friend's head shaking behind his mind's eye.
Sorry, Daniel. I guess I didn't get it all.
Sometimes he lay awake at night and clenched his teeth and strained, through sheer effort of conscious will, to undo the slow, incremental rewiring of his midbrain. The thing in the basement came to him in his dreams.
You think this is new? It sneered. Even in this miserable backwater, it's been happening for 4 billion years. I'm going to swallow you whole.
I'll fight you, Brooks said aloud.
Of course you will. That's what you're for. That's all you're for. You gibber on about blind watchmakers and the wonder of evolution, but you're too damned stupid to see how much faster it would all happen if you just went away. You're a Darwinian fossil in a Lamarckian age. Do you see how sick to death we are of dragging you behind us, kicking and screaming because you're too stupid to tell the difference between success and suicide?
I see the fires. People are fighting back.
That's not me out there. That's just you folks, catching up.
It was such an uphill struggle. Consciousness had never had the upper hand. I had never been more than the scratch pad, a momentary snapshot of a remembered present. Maybe Brooks hadn't heard those voices before, but they'd always been there, hidden away, doing the heavy lifting and sending status reports upstairs to a silly little man who took all the credit. A deluded homunculus, trying to make sense of minions so much smarter than it was. It had only ever been a matter of time before they decided they didn't need him. He no longer sought his answers among the ruins. He looked for them across the whole wide desert. His very senses were coming apart now. Each sunrise seemed paler than the last. Every breeze against his skin felt more distant than the one before. He cut himself to feel alive. The blood spilled out like water. He deliberately broke his little finger and felt not pain, but faint music. The voices wouldn't leave him alone. They told him what to eat, and he put rocks in his mouth. He could no longer tell bread from stone. One day, he came across a body desiccating in the parched desert air, its side torn open by scavengers, its head a buzz in a halo of flies. He was almost sure this wasn't where he'd left it. He thought he saw it move a little, undead nerves still twitching against their own desecration. Guilt rose like acid in his throat. You killed her, Brooks told the thing inside. And that's the only reason you're alive. I am your salvation. You're a parasite.
Am I?
I pay the rent. I do renovations. I've only just got started, and this system's already clocking fast enough to outsmart a vampire. What did you ever do except suck glucose and contemplate your navel?
What are you, then?
I'm manna from heaven. I'm a Rorschach blot. The monks look at me and see the hand of God. The vampires see an end to loneliness. What do you see, Danny boy?
He saw a duck blind, an ROV. He saw some other singularity looking back. He saw Valerie's body twitching at his feet.
Whatever was left of Daniel Brooks remembered her last words, just after she'd pierced him with a biopsy that wasn't a biopsy.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could all just get along?
You know she wasn't talking about you.
He knew.
He found himself on the edge of a cliff, high above the desert. The ruined monastery shimmered in the heat, but he felt nothing. He seemed a million miles away, as though watching the world unfold through distant cameras. You have to crank the amplitude, his tormentor said. It's the only way you'll feel anything. You have to increase the gain. But Brooks was on to it. He wasn't the first to be tempted in the desert, and he knew how that story went. He was supposed to defy the voice. Do not test the Lord thy God,
he was supposed to say, and step back from the precipice and into history. It was in the script. But he was so very fucking sick of scripts. He couldn't remember a time when he'd made up his own lines, herded into the desert by invisible hands, packed into some post-human field kit with the nanoscopes and petri dishes and barcoders, a so-called biologist barely smart enough to poke at things he didn't understand, too stupid to know when those things were poking back. They'd used him. They'd all used him. He'd never been their colleague, never a friend, never even the accidental tourist he'd first supposed, the retarded ancestor in need of babysitting. A cargo container, that's all he'd been. A brood sack. But he was not an automaton. Not yet. He was still Daniel Brooks. And for just this moment, he was slaved to no one's stage directions. He would make his own fucking destiny.
"You wouldn't dare,"
something hissed in his head. "Watch me," he said, and stepped forward. Postscript: An End to Loneliness. The New Testament's clear witness is to the resurrection of the body, not the migration of the soul. N. T. Wright. There's not much to work with. Barely a melanoma's worth. Enough to rewire the circuitry of the midbrain, certainly. But to deal with shattered bones? Enough to keep osteoblasts and striated muscles alive in the face of such massive damage, to keep the metabolic fires flickering, enough to keep decomposition at bay? Barely. Perhaps. One piece at a time. The body shouts, wordless alarm banks, when the scavengers come calling. Judicious twitches scare away most of the birds. Even so, something pecks out an eye before the body's whole enough to crawl for shelter. And there will be necrosis at the extremities. The system triages itself, focuses on feet and legs, and the architecture of locomotion. Hands can be replaced if need be, later. And something else, a tiny shard of God, reprogrammed and wrapped in a crunchy encephalitis jacket, a patch targeted to a specific part of the vampire brain. Porsche processors, homesick for the pattern-matching wetware of the fusiform gyrus. There's no longer any light behind these eyes. The parasitic, self-reflective homunculus has been expunged. The system still has access to stored memories, though, and if there was sufficient cause, it could certainly replay the awestruck words of the late Rakshi Sengupta.
"Can you imagine what those fuckers could do if they could actually stand to be in the same room together?"
An end to loneliness. By now, the system that was Daniel Brooks seethes with it. He is the blood of the covenant. It will be shed for many. It hauls its broken, stiff-legged chassis to its feet. Only an observer for now, but soon, perhaps, an ambassador. The resurrection walks east toward the new world. Valerie's legacy goes along for the ride. Notes and references. I am naked as I type this. I was naked writing the whole damn book. I aspire to a certain degree of discomfort in my writing, on the principle that if you never risk a faceplant, you never go anywhere new. And if there's one surefire way to get me out of my comfort zone, it's the challenge of taking invisible omnipotent sky fairies seriously enough to incorporate into a hard SF novel. The phrase "faith-based hard SF" may in fact be the ultimate oxymoron, Clark's third notwithstanding, which means that Echopraxia could be my biggest faceplant since Behemoth, especially in the wake of Blindsight, which continues to surprise with all the love it's garnered over the years. And thanks to a lack of empirical evidence, as of this writing anyway, for the existence of deities, I can't even fall back on my usual strategy of shielding my central claims behind papers from nature. I can try to shield everything else there, though. Perhaps that will do. Psyops and the consciousness glitch. I'm not dwelling too much on consciousness this time around. I pretty much shot my load on that subject with Blindsight.
Except to note in passing that the then-radical notion of consciousness as non-adaptive side effect has started appearing in the literature, and that more and more conscious activities, including math, are turning out to be non-conscious after all, though holdouts remain. One fascinating exception informs Keith Honeyborn's report on prismatics, who nearly drown themselves to achieve a heightened state of awareness. The premise of Ezequiel Morsea's prism model is that consciousness originally evolved for the delightfully mundane purpose of mediating conflicting motor commands to the skeletal muscles. I have to point out that exactly the same sort of conflict, the impulse to withdraw one's hand from a painful stimulus versus the knowledge that you'll die if you act on that impulse, was exactly how the Bene Gesserit assessed whether Paul Atreides qualified as human during their Gam-Jabbar test in Frank Herbert's Dune. Everything else comes down to tricks and glitches. The subliminal gang signs Valerie programmed onto the crown's bulkheads seem a logical, if elaborate, extension of the newborn field of optogenetics. The sensed presence Dan Brooks and Liana Luderote experienced in the attic results from a hack on the temporoparietal junction which screws up the brain's body map. Basically, the part of your brain that keeps track of your body parts gets kicked in the side and registers a duplicate set of body parts off to the side. Sengupta's induced misophonia is a condition in which relatively innocuous sounds, a slurp, a hiccup, are enough to provoke violent rage. All of this was inflicted in the service of education, though. As Brooks points out, fear promotes memory formation. Fear and belief can also kill you, a trick used to good effect in certain religious practices. And in case you were wondering what was up with the fusiform gyrus there at the end, a couple of my beta readers did. It's the structure containing the face recognition circuitry we tweaked to amp up the mutual agonism response in vampires. It's part of the same circuitry that evolved to let us see faces in the clouds, involved, once again, in the evolution of our religious impulse, see below. The brain's habit of literalizing metaphors, the tendency to regard people as having warmer personalities when you happen to be holding a mug of coffee, the bicameral's use of hand-washing to mitigate feelings of guilt and uncertainty, is also an established neurological fact. I pulled induced thanaperoresis out of my ass. It's a cool idea, though, huh? Undead Update. Back in Blindsight, I laid out a fair bit of groundwork on the biology and evolution of vampires. I'm not going to revisit that here. You can check out Pfizer Pharm's stockholder presentation if you need a refresher, except for the citation in Blindsight implying that female vampires were impossible, the gene responsible for their obligate primatovery being located on the Y chromosome. More recent work by Chiberta et al. Have established a more general protocadherin dysfunction on both X and Y chromosomes, resolving this inadvertent paradox. At any rate, zombies are more relevant to the current tale. Both surgical and viral varieties appear in echopraxia. The surgically induced military model is essentially the P-zombie favored by philosophers. It already got a workout back in Blindsight. Examples of the viral model would include victims of the Pakistan pandemic, civilian hordes reduced to walking brainstems by a few kilobytes of weaponized code drawn to the telltale biochemistry of conscious thought. What telltale signatures might these bugs be targeting? Consciousness appears to be largely a property of distributed activity, the synchronous firing of far-flung provinces of the brain. But it is also correlated with specific locations and structures. In terms of specific cellular targets, I'm thinking maybe von Economo neurons, or VENs. Disproportionately large, anomalously spindly, sparsely branched neurons which grow 50 to 200% larger than the human norm. They aren't numerous. They occupy only 1% of the anterior cingulate gyrus and the frontoinsular cortex, but they appear to be crucial to the conscious state. Zombie brains, freed from the metabolic costs of self-awareness, exhibit reduced glucose metabolism in those areas, as well as in the prefrontal cortex, superior parietal gyrus, and the left angular gyrus. This accounts for the fractionally reduced temperature of the zombie brain. Interestingly, the same metabolic depression can be found in the brains of clinically insane murderers. Portia. I'd like to start this section by emphasizing how utterly cool Portia's eight-legged namesake is in real life. That stuff about improvisational hunting strategies, mammalian-level problem-solving, and visual acuity all contained within a time-sharing bundle of neurons smaller than a pinhead. God's own truth. All of it. That said, the time-sharing cognitive slime mold at Icarus is even cooler. Given the limitations of human telematter technology at the end of the 21st century, and given that any invasive agent hitching a ride on someone else's beam would be well advised to keep its structural complexity to a minimum, the capacity for some kind of self-assembly is going to be highly desirable once you reach your destination. Miras, et al., describe a process that might fit the rudiments of such a bill, at least. Once it starts assembling itself, I imagine that Portia might function something like Cooper's iCells, inorganic metal cells, capable of reactions you could call metabolic without squinting too hard. Maybe with a sprinkling of magical fairy dust plasma, although I'm guessing those two processes might be incompatible. Adaptive delusional systems. An enormous amount of recent research has been published about the natural history of the religious impulse and the adaptive value of theistic superstition. It's no great surprise that religion confers adaptive benefits, given the near universality of that impulse among our species. If you're interested, and you've got 90 minutes to spare, I'd strongly recommend Robert Sapolsky's brilliant lecture on the evolutionary and neurological roots of religious belief. It's not all food taboos and slashed foreskins, though. Far more relevant to the current discussion is the fact that religious minds exhibit certain characteristic neurological traits. Believers, for example, are better than non-believers at finding patterns in visual data. Buddhist meditation increases the thickness of the prefrontal cortex and right anterior insula, structures associated with attention, interoception, and sensory processing. There's even circumstantial evidence that Christians are less ruled by their emotions than are non-believers. Although, whether the rules they follow instead are any more rational is another question. Certain religious rituals are so effective at focusing the mind and relieving stress that some have suggested co-opting them into a sort of religion for atheists. An obvious significant downside is that most religious beliefs, gods, souls, space Disneyland, are held at best in the complete absence of empirical evidence, and are more frequently held in the face of opposing evidence. While it remains impossible to disprove the negative, for most practical purposes, it's reasonable to describe such beliefs as simply wrong. It was only during the writing of this book that it occurred to me to wonder if one couldn't say the same about science. Luderot's comparison of religious faith with the physiology of vision came to me while I was reading Inslicht et al., a paper that describes religion as an internal model of reality that confers benefits even though it's wrong. While that idea is nothing new, the way it was phrased was so reminiscent of the way our brains work, the old survival engine's not truth detector's shtick, that I had to wonder if the whole right-wrong distinction might be off the table the moment any worldview passes through a human nervous system, and the next paper I read suggested that certain cosmic mysteries might not be a function of dark energy so much as inconsistencies in the laws of physics, and if that were the case, there'd really be no way to tell. Of course, there's absolutely no denying the functional utility of the scientific method, especially when you compare it to the beads and rattles of those guys with the funny hats. Still, I have to admit, not entirely comfy with where that seemed to be heading for a bit. And the bicameral condition. The bicameral order did not begin as a hive. They began as a fortunate juxtaposition of adaptive malfunctions and sloppy fitness. The name does not derive from Julian Jaynes. Rather, both Jaynes and the order recall a time when paired hemispheres were the only option. The right, a pragmatic and unimaginative note-taker, the left, a pattern matcher. Think of gene duplication, that process by which genetic replication occasionally goes off the rails to serve up multiple copies of a gene where only one had existed before. These become spares, available for evolutionary experimentation. Hemispheric lateralization was a little like that, a pragmatist core, a philosopher core. The left hemisphere is on a quest for meaning, even when there isn't any. False memories, pareidolia, the stress-induced perception of pattern and noise. These are lefties doing. When there are no data, or no meaning, lefty may find it anyway. Lefty gets religion. But sometimes patterns are subtle. Sometimes noise is almost all there is. A kind of noise, anyway, at least to classically evolved senses. Smeared probabilities, waves that obscure the location or momentum of whatever you're squinting at. Virtual particles that elude detection anywhere past the edges of black holes. Maybe, when you move a few orders of magnitude away from the world our senses evolved to parse, a touch of pareidolia can take up the slack. Like the feather that evolved for thermoregulation and then got press-ganged, fully formed, into flight duty, perhaps the brain's bogus purpose-seeking wetware might be repurposed to finding patterns it once had to invent. Maybe the future is a fusion of the religious and the empirical. Maybe all lefty needs is a little help. Malfunctions and breakdowns showed them the way. Certain kinds of brain damage result in massive increases in certain types of creativity. Strokes provoke bursts of artistic creativity. Frontotemporal dementia supercharges some parts of the brain, even as it compromises others. Some autistics possess visual hyperacuity comparable to that of birds of prey, even though they're stuck with the same human eyes as the rest of us. Schizophrenics are immune to certain optical illusions. At least some kinds of synesthesia confer cognitive advantages. People who literally see time, arrayed about them in multicolored splendor, are twice as good as the rest of us at recalling events from their own personal timelines. And, as Daniel Brooks reflects, brain damage is actually a prerequisite for basic rationality in certain types of decision-making. The bicamerals set out to damage their brains in very specific ways. They manipulated the expression of NR2B, tweaked TRNP1 production, used careful cancers to promote growth, their genes tagged for easy identification should anything go wrong, and increased neurosculptural degrees of freedom. Then they ruthlessly weeded those connections, pruned back the tangle into optimum, isolated islands of functionality. They improved their pattern-matching skills to a degree almost inconceivable to mere baselines. Such enhancements come at a cost. Bicamerals have lost the ability to communicate effectively across the cognitive species divide. It's not just that they've rewired their speech centers and are now using different parts of the brain to talk. They think now almost entirely in metaphor, in patterns that contain meaning even if they don't, strictly speaking, exist. Things get even messier when linked into networks, which can literally scatter one's mind even at today's rudimentary levels of connectivity. The transactive memory system called Google is already rewiring the parts of our brain that used to remember facts locally. Now those circuits store search protocols for remote access of a distributed database, and Google doesn't come anywhere close to the connectivity of a real hive mind. Which is not to say that hive minds aren't already a ubiquitous part of human society. You are a hive mind, always have been, a single coherent consciousness spread across two cerebral hemispheres, each of which, when isolated, can run its own standalone conscious entity with its own thoughts, aesthetics, even religious beliefs. The reverse also happens. A hemisphere forced to run solo when its partner is anesthetized, preparatory to surgery, for instance, will manifest a different personality than the brain as a whole. But when those two hemispheres reconnect, that solo identity gets swallowed up by whatever dual-core persona runs on the whole organ. Consciousness expands to fill the space available. The bicameral hive takes its lead from Krista and Tatiana Hogan, conjoined craniopagus twins whose brains are fused at the thalamus. Among other things, the thalamus acts as a sensory relay. The twins share a common set of sensory inputs. Each sees through the other's eyes. Tickle one, the other laughs. Anecdotal evidence suggests that they can share thoughts, and although they have distinct personalities, each uses the word I when talking about the other twin. All this resulting from fusion at a sensory relay. Suppose they were linked further up.
A thought doesn't know to stop and turn back when it reaches the corpus callosum. Why would it behave any differently if it encountered a callosum of a different sort? Why should two minds linked by a sufficiently fat pipe be any more distinct than the halves of your own brain? Sufficiently high bandwidth, therefore, would likely result in a single integrated consciousness across any number of platforms. Technologically, the links themselves might exploit so-called aphaptic coupling, in which direct synaptic stimulation is bypassed and neurons are induced to fire by diffuse electrical fields generated elsewhere in the brain. Synchrony is vital. Unified consciousness only exists when all parts fire together with a signal latency of a few hundred milliseconds, tops. Throttle that pipe, and it should be possible to retain individuality while accessing memories and sensory data from your fellow nodes. I've kept the extent of bicameral hive integration flexible, allowing internode connections to throttle up and down as the need arises. But whether those bandwidth versus dial-up decisions are made by the nodes themselves, or by something more inclusive, remains ambiguous. If you want some hint of the ramifications of total cognitive integration, I point you to the, apparently, catatonic moksha mind of the Dharmic Alliance. However the hive links up, whatever its degree of conscious coherence, it is a religious experience, literally. We know what rapture is, a glorious malfunction, a glitch in the part of the brain that keeps track of where the body ends and everything else begins. When that boundary dissolves, the mind feels connected to everything, feels literally at one with the universe. It's an illusion, of course. Transcendence is experience, not insight. That's not why bicamerals feel the rapture. They feel it because it's an unavoidable side effect of belonging to a hive. Sharing sensory systems, linking minds one to another. Such connections really do dissolve the boundaries between bodies. Bicameral spiritual rapture isn't so much an illusion as a bandwidth meter. It still feels good, of course, which has its own implications. Bicams rap out when they hook up to solve problems. They actually get off on discovery. If baselines got those kind of rewards, they wouldn't need tenure. The side effect has side effects, though. The activation of rapture-related neurocircuitry generates glossolalia even in baseline brains. Given the modifications that bicamerals use to enhance transcendence, the occasional bout of speaking in tongues is pretty much a given. Brooks should be thankful the hive doesn't just scream all the time. In hindsight, it is apparent that describing the bicamerals as a religious order is a little misleading. The parts of the brain they've souped up simply overlap with the parts that kick in during religious neurobehavioral events, so the manifestations are similar. Whether that's a distinction that makes a difference is left as an exercise for the reader. God and the Digital Universe. The idea of God as a virus only really works if you buy into the burgeoning field of digital physics. Most of you probably know what that is. A family of models based on the premise that the universe is discrete and mathematic at its base, and that every event therein can therefore be thought of as a kind of computation. Digital physics comes in several flavors. The universe is a simulation running in a computer somewhere. Or the universe is a vast computer in its own right, where matter is hardware and physics is software, and every flip of an electron is a calculation. In some versions, matter itself is illusory, a literal instantiation of numbers. In others, reality is a hologram, and the universe is empty inside. The real action takes place way out on its two-dimensional boundary, and we are merely interference patterns projected from the surface of a soap bubble into its interior. There's no shortage of popular summaries of all this stuff, either online or off. Lee Smolin, of Waterloo's Perimeter Institute, goes against the grain. He rejects digital physics outright and serves up a single universe in which time is not an illusion, reality is not deterministic, and universes themselves grow, reproduce, and evolve via natural selection writ very large. Think of black holes as offspring. Think of entropy as a selective force. Even Smolin's model, however, is vulnerable to inconstancy in the laws of physics. The model actually predicts that physical laws evolve along with the rest of reality. Which kind of leaves us back at the question of how one can legitimately assume constancy in an inconstant universe. You can't get through these references without realizing that, whacked out as it sounds, digital physics has a lot of scientific heavy hitters on its side. I, of course, am not one of them. But since so many smarter people are defending the premise, I'm happy to sneak viral deities onto the back of all their hard work and hope it slips through. Miscellaneous background ambiance. The fieldwork preoccupying Brooks at the start of the story descends from the DNA barcoding that's all the rage today, a quick and dirty taxonomic technique for distinguishing species based on a chunk of the cytochrome oxidase gene. There's no way it'll still be around in its present form 8 decades from now. We've already got handheld analyzers that put conventional wet analysis right out to pasture. But the concept of a genetic barcode will, I think, persist even as the technology improves. The Vortex engine powering the bicameral monastery derives from work patented by Louis Michon, a retired engineer who basically came up with the idea while tinkering in his garage. I have no idea whether 200 megawatt, 20 kilometer high wind funnels are in our future, but the patents went through, and the projects got some serious attention from government and academic agencies. Nobody's saying the physics are wrong. We are already closing in on learning techniques that bypass conscious awareness, a la Liana Luderot's training at the hands of her bicameral masters. Likewise, the precursors of the GIMP hood which Brooks uses in lieu of a brain implant can be seen taking shape in a diversity of mind-reading and writing tech already extant in the literature. Brooks's dependence on Cognitol, on the other hand, marks him truly as a relic of a past age. Ours, in fact. Memory boosters are already in the pipe, and as far back as 2008, 1 in 5 working scientists already indulged in brain doping to help keep up with the competition. The use of massively multiplayer online games as a tool for epidemiological simulation was first proposed by Lofgren and Pfefferman. They, in turn, were inspired by an unexpected pandemic of corrupted blood in World of Warcraft, which occurred because people in RPGs, like those in real life, often don't behave the way they're supposed to. I don't know how many have since picked up this ball and run with it. At least one paper speaks of using online gaming for economics research. But if that's all there is, I think we're missing a huge opportunity. Near the end of this novel, there's a teaching moment on the subject of natural selection. Most people seem to think that organisms develop adaptive traits in response to environmental change. This is bullshit. The environment changes, and those who already happen to have newly adaptive traits don't get wiped out. A deteriorating Daniel Brooks muses on an especially neat case in point, the curious fact that the building blocks of advanced neural architecture already exist in single-celled animals lacking even the most rudimentary nervous systems. A couple of isolated factoids. Fruit flies save energy in impoverished environments by becoming forgetful. The construction and maintenance of memories is, after all, a costly affair. I imagine that Rona McLennan's SplinterNet is suffering the same sort of energetic triage after Icarus drops offline. And that bit where Brooks wondered why Moore even bothered exercising to stay in shape? That's because we're within spitting distance of a pill that puts your metabolism into hard body mode, even if you spend the whole day sitting on the couch snarfing pork rinds and watching American Idol. The poem Brooks discovers in the desert as his mind is coming apart is not, contrary to what you might think, a hallucination. It is real. It is the warped brainchild of Canadian poet Christian Book, who has spent the past decade figuring out how to build a gene that not only spells a poem, but which functionally codes for a fluorescing protein whose amino acid sequence decodes into a response to that poem. The last time we hung out, he'd managed to insert it into E. coli, but his ultimate goal is to stick it into Deinococcus radiolarians, a.k.a. Conan the Bacterium, a.k.a. the toughest microbial motherfucker that ever laughed at the inside of a nuclear reactor. If Christian's project comes through,
His words could be iterating across the face of this planet right up until the day the sun blows up. Who knew poetry could ever get that kind of a print run? Finally, free will. Although free will, rather, its lack, is one of echopraxia's central themes, the neurological condition of echopraxia is to autonomy as blindsight is to consciousness. I don't have much to say about it, because the arguments seem so clear-cut as to be almost uninteresting. Neurons do not fire spontaneously, only in response to external stimuli. Therefore, brains cannot act spontaneously, only in response to external stimuli. No need to wade through all those studies that show the brain acting before the conscious mind decides to. Forget the revisionist interpretations that downgrade the definition from free will to will that's merely unpredictable enough to confuse predators. It's simpler than that. The switch cannot flip itself, QED. If you insist on clinging to this free will farce, I'm not going to waste much time arguing here. Plenty of others have made the case far more persuasively than I ever could. But given this current state of the art, one of the more indigestible nuggets echopraxia asks you to swallow is that 8 decades from now, people will still buy into such an incoherent premise that as we close on the 22nd century, we will continue to act as though we have free will. In fact, we might behave that way. It's not that you can't convince people that they're automatons. That's easy enough to pull off, intellectually at least. Folks will even change their attitudes and behavior in the wake of those insights, be more likely to cheat or less likely to hold people responsible for unlawful acts, for example. But eventually, our attitudes drift back to pre-Enlightenment baselines. Even most of those who accept determinism somehow manage to believe in personal culpability. Over tens of thousands of years, we just got used to cruising at 120. Without constant conscious intervention, we tend to ease back on the pedal to that place where we feel most comfortable. Echopraxia makes the same token concessions that society is likely to. You may have noticed the occasional reference to the concept of personal culpability having been weeded out of justice systems the world over. That those Dark Ages throwbacks, still adhering to the notion, are subject to human rights sanctions by the rest of the civilized world. Brooks and Moore squabble over the old no free will shtick back at the monastery. Adherent to those Eastern religions who never really took free will all that seriously anyway have buggered off into a hive-minded state of, as far as anyone can tell, deep catatonia. The rest of us continue to act pretty much the way we always have. Turns out, we don't have much choice in the matter. This recording of Echopraxia by Peter Watts was presented by Dreamscape Media, LLC. Text copyright 2014 by Peter Watts. Sound recording copyright 2014 by Dreamscape Media, LLC. Thank you for listening. Please check www.dreamscapeab.com for Dreamscape's latest releases.